Midrash full.
Yeah.
Good. Welcome back to the Beit Midrash, or to the Beit Midrash. Nice to see everybody.
Yes.
And I have a few handouts today, too. So if you didn't have the handouts yet, I want to make sure that you have a packet. Mary, you had this from the last time, yeah?
No, I don't have.
Fasting in the Jewish tradition.
I have it.
Okay, just got it. Good. I didn't pass it out?
No, you didn't.
Oh, you see, I was keeping it for this week. And I distributed it this week. Thank you for keeping me in order already. There were those who said, in my mind, that I passed it out last week. But yay, Shomrim, but then the other sages said...
It's very hard to
get. So, right. But the reason why I passed it out is because I want to bring you into source on the outside here. Rabbi Shalom Gonsfried, who wrote the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, which was a shortened compendium of laws that stemmed out of the Shulchan Aruch, which was the 16th century code of law written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, Tzfat, and the Ashkenazic glosses on the Shulchan Aruch called the Set Table were created, and then that was Rabbi Moshe Isserles from Poland, and that became, in a sense, the key to the realm in terms of halachic observance and halachic legal codes. There's lots of arguments why that book, Davka, becomes the book that's so popular. One of them is for the wonderful way that Karo is known as a mystic in addition to a halachist, a legal soul, that he could combine the worlds of both mysticism and legal, Jewish legal traditional ways of thinking about the world, and he's accepted as an authority immediately because he really knew of all those different mystical tastes for the Torah and for the mitzvot, and he also knew of the very pragmatic levels of Torah observance. Another explanation is that it was absolutely a utilitarian reality that brought about the popularity of the Shulchan Aruch, which was that it was printed in a small edition, and it was one of the first kind of halachic codes mass-produced in mass meaning for that time, and that it was distributed widely, and that people had it, and it really gained an incredible amount of popularity because of its chapbook size, in addition to there being, you know, a manuscript of it, and folios, and the like. So that the more you had the distribution of a book, the more popular the book became. You know, by the way, this goes back to the first century and our age of the Talmud, right? Because if you want to talk about the history of the book, you talk about the actual notion that we, in terms of spreading the word, had scrolls that were kept in sacred precincts called synagogues, and we would come and gather in the Beit Knesset, and we would read them, and we would hold up the scroll and re-scroll it and keep it in the collection box, and we had different scrolls. But by early church fathers, even before that, by the time of the apostles, before that time of teachings of the early church, they decided that the codices were okay, and you didn't need to have the sacred scripture on a scroll, so it was much more portable. And when it says that a man named Jesus of Galilee went into the Galilee to go preach, he could have very well had the text he needed right in front of him on a different kind of paper. Because and we know that there's so many different laws about what we write our scrolls on and what kind of kashrut we need for them to be kosher scrolls and when we read them. So all this, that's to say, is a historical reality for all time, including today. How does something really take off in terms of its popularity? They call certain videos, what do you call it when you get a million hits?
Viral.
Yeah, something goes viral, right? So it should only be that some kind of, you know, halacha gets the term, like, it went viral.
Their Bible's been viral in every hotel room in America.
That's right, there you go. The Bible is viral like that. But I mean, so the World Zionist Organization, I think before the internet and before YouTube, tried to really say that Jewish law and observing Jewish law could be that viral by publishing a 3-volume series called Popular Halacha, which, you know, how popular halacha outside of a certain small community of Jews. But given that reality, the Shulchan Aruch was popular halacha. It really was. It was popular halacha. And the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch made kind of a summary of a lot of what was in the Shulchan Aruch in the 19th century. And sometimes, by the way, even though it says Kitzer, that it's a shorter version, there's one or another passage that's a little longer than others in the Shulchan Aruch, because he's giving you a little bit more of a rational explanation. Because by the 19th century, we needed the understanding, we needed the essence of the rationalization of why one might do what one is commanded to do. That is to say, last week, we read Mishnayot from our first chapter that commanded us regarding times of real trouble, calamity, natural disasters, things that faced the Jewish community, things that faced the Jewish people, and that we could have responses to those kind of worries, concerns, actualities, and the drought particularly. We said we were going to organize a series of fasts. So we started into understanding what those calls for fasting would look like if mostly we're talking about the land of Israel, but if the rabbis are projecting an active Jewish community upon which they can kind of write over the notion that we are Israel wherever we are, and they're, I think, in some ways either very much trying to assert that leadership or they're at least fantasizing about it, the way we would say it, like in a religious fantasy kind of way, that we would have our own authority. And if the authorities would only give us space to run our community exactly the way we would do it. So that definitely in the land of Israel, though, we would have these fasts. 3 days of fasts by three days of fasting by the most important players, religious players that you trusted in the community. 3 days of the wider council of people who should take on fasts. And then if that didn't work to bring about the rain in its season, then you had seven more to get to 13 different fasts. And those fasts went Monday, Thursday, Monday. And they were fasts unlike Tisha B'Av or Yom Kippur that went from sunrise to sunset, which are more like what we call in the Jewish calendar minor fasts, right? Because we want to make those days of beseeching God in order to do it in the deepest way. We're going to get a little bit more tonight about what did that look like. And those calls, according to the scholar Larry Hoffman, who's a scholar of ancient liturgy and a scholar of religious practice, who taught for a long time at Hebrew Union College, who recently retired, he said that those public fasts and the call for the public to be involved with those fasts was probably some of the earliest gatherings for prayer, not in the temple and not in a synagogue space, but that, like you see sometimes, you're flying to Israel and you're there for an LL flight and all of a sudden mincha is happening. they very well could be praying for a really safe flight. Who knows what's really going through those heads and hearts. But over here, for sure, there was public prayer, and it didn't necessarily have to happen in the synagogue. Could be in an area where there's a drought where they didn't yet have one of those structures. And there were some structural synagogues long before the temple was destroyed. We know this from Professor Lee Levine, whom we've mentioned many times. There's ancient synagogue space that definitely was used. But maybe it wasn't used for a full-out synagogue liturgical experience, like we explain what synagogue liturgy looks like today. Maybe it was a gathering for reading of the public Torah scroll, or the public section of Torah that was necessary, and studying. Maybe it was more like a study house, where you had some prayers attached. The liturgy hadn't completely been developed, and over years the liturgy gets a little bit more developed, but the call, for sure, when you didn't have rain, and that you needed this place to come to say these prayers in the order that we knew them from having a daily liturgy defined, even before daily liturgy defined, that could have been the beginnings of, and stirrings of bringing people together on a routine basis. Over time, the liturgy does get developed. You have Shema, you have those people who are saying blessings before and after the Shema. You have the Amidah. Traditions say that Anshei Knesset Hagadolah create the Nusach for the Amidah. That means that people in the diaspora during the Purim time, to link it to our time frame here in the year, they were involved in already conceiving of prayers when they were in the diaspora, and that we needed prayers versus a centralized place for worshiping God with sacrifice in the temple times. And then the Second Temple era is the time that liturgy continues to get developed. And so you have the Shema and its blessings, and you have the Amidah and its 18, or what will become 19 blessings, even though we continue to call it the 18 blessings, because we're Jews, we can do that. And so you have this developing liturgy going on, and Toch Kedei, within that liturgy, we're going to see that there are special liturgies for this purpose of fasting at a public level to bring about rain in its season. And so fasting, which we saw in Masechet Yoma, we saw in the Masechet that's all about Yom Kippur, that fasting has a unique kind of set of whys and wherefores and the reasons behind it over there for religious purposes. Over here, we know what the purpose is, and that is to bring about rain in its season and to ask God for then a certain, and that could be used analogically, to bring about a certain kind of movement in heaven to make provisions for the earth below. And so fasting takes on that kind of power within the tradition. We're going to see tonight how the liturgy develops. And before we do that, I bring you to this outside source, which summarized in the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch what the mitzvah is in terms of fasting in quote-unquote in our times. But we're projecting back this being somewhat of a summary as to why and what happens, why they think it might have happened, and what they are doing when they respond to it, when drought is apparent and there is tsuris in community and we need to make a response as a community. So Kitzer Shulchan Aruch, mitzvah al kol da Yisrael. It says it's a mitzvah on every Jewish community, she'al kol tsara shelo tavo, when they're beset with trouble, that it shouldn't come. You have to read it like it. She'al kol tsara shelo tavo, you know, on every trouble, that it shouldn't come and puh. In other words, that's the part that you spit out. You know, the superstitious part. Shalotavo. That it shouldn't come to us. Yit anu, they should fast. V'yit pavalu, and they should pray. Al tzaratam lifnei Hashem yibarach shemo. They should fast and pray on all that trouble before God. Blessed is God's name. V'im, ein ha'et mukhsheret lehitanot. But if it's not time that's appropriate for fasting, and obviously then the question is halachically, what does that mean in terms of time being appropriate or not appropriate for fasting? And we'll come to answer that question as we read more into our Mishnayot all the way back from thousands of years ago. But here he gives you an example. Kagon, shenir dafim, she'enam reshaim lehitanot. For instance, if people are fleeing and they're not permitted to fast, right? There's a little bit of recognition of Jewish history within a halachic code, right? One has to be informed by history that, you know, they were fleeing sometimes and they had a lot of tsuris, and you could look back, and by the way, this is really, they say, a finger in the rib to those people who would say, you see, when they were kicked out, they should have stopped and they should have fasted and they should have entreated God, they should have prayed. No, they shouldn't have. Because during a time when you're fleeing is not the time to sit and fast and pray. Right? And that's a big theological issue in the world still. Shelo l'shaber kocham, they're not permitted to break their strength. Yikablu alehem lehitanot v'kach v'kach, they should take on, though, to say, we will fast in the future, Hashem, if you will help save us. Taniot lich sheyinatzlu, they should have fasts when they are saved. V'nechshav lehem ki'ilu hitanu ata, it will be thought of as if they are fasting right now, those who cannot fast because they are fleeing in the midst of tsuris and being attacked violently. They would have pledged to fast in the future, and it would have been thought of as if they fasted right then at that point that they needed God's help. Ki dematzinu b'Daniel, as it says in Daniel. Interesting here, we've often had this discussion. When I bring a proof text, am I looking for only a Torah verse, or does sometimes I get a proof text in our tradition, meaning a verse that's going to back me up, from even the prophets or even the writings, right? And here, I get a proof text from Daniel. I get a proof text from the writings part of the Tanakh. V'yomer, and he says, V'yomer elai al tira Daniel ki min hayom asher natata et libcha lahavin lehit anot lifnei elohecha nishma'u divarecha. He said to me, don't be afraid, Daniel. From the day you resolved to understand and to fast before your God, your words were heard. So I wanted to bring this selection from the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch to say that up until today, because we too still don't nullify and cancel these, though it is a less common occurrence to declare public fasts, and I was just looking through a couple on Monday afternoon, I was doing a little learning towards tonight, I said, you know what would be really interesting? If the Reform movement or the Conservative movement or the Reconstructionist movement ever declared a public fast, right? So when do you think the only public fasts were that were declared? Because you could probably start and say, no, we didn't declare a public fast because of Tzuris and then fast 3 days in a row, Monday or Monday, Thursday, Monday, the fast sets of fasts we're talking about for any kind of particular... Okay, so you might think that the only time that it made real sense was the Holocaust, right? There were Orthodox Rabbanim who definitely did say, take on fasts. I did not find in the archives anybody from the liberal movements who said take on Monday, Thursday, Monday fasts.
I would go back to 17, the Kiev massacres.
So maybe the pogroms, and that the violence that was so shocking, and as the news stories carried more pictures, right, because this is part and parcel of what made for such shocking reality stick here in America, right, and I saw those.
I guess it would be redundant to do it on the Yom Kippur War.
There you go. Redundancy was not called for.
We're
already fasting. But okay, so meanwhile, the only public fasts I found in the liberal movements are those that are in a different category of fasting, and they are for when Torahs drop on the ground. So there's a tradition that you fast for 40 days, meaning you take on 40 days worth of fasting, or you take 40 people and you say to each of them, fast for a day, sunrise to sunset, and we'll make kapara, and we'll make, we'll focus here on keeping aloft our Torah and our Torah values. But I didn't find any others, just as a side note.
Did you find any writings about it?
No shikulim, no anything. I haven't gone to the archives. To me, it's an interesting question as to whether the archives would have any in terms of the archives of the Rabbinical Assembly and some of the conferences that they ran, but I didn't find any publicly out there so far.
I would comment it's still pretty good because I don't know that it would happen today as a fast for a Torah in a Reform synagogue.
Oh, I don't know about that. Actually, I don't know about that. I think that people take so seriously the notion of dropping a Torah to this day, thank God, that there would probably be a response. I'll tell you that there was a response in a Reform synagogue in Israel where they actualized the ritual and they connected to it. I mean, again, in Israel, I think the culture is a little bit more immediately connected to some of what's going on next door. But I don't want to put it past the crowds, and there was a tshuva on it from the conservative movement for the American scene. So I think it would be really interesting to see. I hear you. That notion that calamity is the falling Torah is the distinction that I want to make, because here we're talking about calamity. When there are calamities, you declare fasts. Ad ha-calamity hazeh, and up to this calamity where we're really being chased out of our homes. Talk about the pogroms. And we're saying, listen, there's Tzuris. The best thing you can do is fast. We understand right now you can't fast, can't at all deplete your strength. But in your mind, religious drama here, religious imagination, imagine you've declared as a community you are going to take on these fasts that we understand to be the fasts of what's called Sheni Chamishi Sheni, Monday, Thursday, Monday. Sheni is the second day of the week. Chamishi is the fifth day of the week. Sheni, the next Monday. Yom Sheni. So it's those days of the week. It'll be thought of for you.
Is there
a quick question. When was the, tell me again, the Kitzer Shulchan Aruch?
19th century.
Yeah, so this kind of fleeing would be on their minds.
Oh, for sure. But this language is used long before that.
Oh.
Long before that. It's
selected specifically as an example?
Unfortunately, it's been in there a long time. You know what I'm saying? It had to be carried through. Had to be carried through. So, no, not unique to the time. Thank God, we would say we would hope that it could be excised, because we shouldn't see that problem or have that problem any longer, but there's no way that it can be excised. Okay, take a look at the Mishnah Berurah, which comes as a 20th century commentary on the words of the Shulchan Aruch. Ein lehitanot. Okay, about that, they don't fast, but they have the custom of being stringent. Im hu chole she'ein bo sakana, bevadai patur milehitanot va'asur lo lahachamir al'atzmo. Just goes to really double down on something else we said about safety and life. It's not just the safety of those who are fleeing. If a person is sick and it's a minor fast, even if he's supposed to be part of the group that's taken on these fasts and being, you know, very much core and central to the group that is to fast and hold out as the, you know, I want to move God here to make sure we don't fall into calamitous hands, or the calamity is about to befall us. If you are ill, you don't endanger your life to fast. And so we have to be very, very stringent on ourselves about that. Eila shenahagu lahachamir, ve'im hem chalushot nirei de'ein lahem lahachamir, mikol makom af hitzrich le'echol lo yit'aneg atzmo. And even, but if you are stringent, and you are going to take on the fast, right, then what you do is you make sure that you shouldn't feast on meat and wine. But you only eat what you need. You only eat what you really need to eat. And about the children, if they have understanding enough to mourn and to be saddened by great calamity and death itself, although we're not obliged to educate them, because they're young and they're not yet of bar mitzvah age, she'ein mechuyavim lechanchan, we're not yet obligated to really say you are obligated to the fast. Afilu ben yudbet shana, even a kid of 12 years old, v'afilu betani sha'ot, and even for a fast of just a few hours, mikol makom, even though they're not really required, ra'ui lechanchan shelo yochlu rak kadei kiyum aguf, they should be made to eat only what is necessary for the day of the fast, for that fast. Haguf, lechem umayim, bread and water, o sha'ar ma'achal, pshut, just simple things to eat, lefi atinok, kadei sheyit ablu ima tzibur. Because we want them to really join the tzibur, the public, in feeling that fast. So, I want to leave it at that for a second.
Does this apply to every Jewish community? Does it apply to the women in the Jewish community or just the men?
Yes, so the question really becomes, are we only talking about men in the Mishnah? The answer is, in the Mishnah, we're almost with certainty, we're talking about the men, right? Except that there are certain times when the tzibor is involved, the entire community, and in that word, many find that what we're talking about, many would think that that language is talking about the men, the women, and even the children of age.
Actually, there's no carve-out for pregnant women, so I just assumed that the women weren't...
Well, we haven't gotten to that yet. There is a source later that I bring about what really applies to pregnant women. Since you asked, let's do that for a second. Because if we don't get to it tonight, and then, you know, we don't see one another... Let me just show you what I included in terms of that issue, because that comes up all the time, in a very real way. And I think did I include it in there?
Yeah, I think so. Who's obligated to fast on the fast days?
Yeah, who's obligated to fast?
What? 917.
What page, I'm sorry?
9 of
17. 9 of 17. Oh, yeah, who's obligated to pass? Okay, good. This is the disco version of the source sheet. I had a shorter one. I'm glad I brought the longer one.
Okay, and the next page
is page 10.
Okay, good. So who's obligated? Let's just, in the middle, it said, Kol chayvim lehitanot arba'at somot halalu ba'asor lifrot skader. We are all obliged to fast 4 fast days, and it's forbidden to breach the fence. Okay? Look at the middle of 9. However, Hakol chayvim lehitanot arba somot, what 4 fasts are we talking about, by the way? What 4 fasts? Let's work backwards. Let's work backwards. We're talking about the 4 fasts that are not Yom Kippur. Tisha B'Av is the big one, and that's the full 24-25 hour fast. Go backwards. 17th of Tammuz. So Esther is going to be in a class by itself.
Okay.
The 10th of Tevet, which comes around which holiday? Hanukkah time. It's always after because Rosh Chodesh Tevet's in Hanukkah, and then you have the 10th of Tevet, and then the one before that is Tzom Gedalia, the 3rd of Tishrei. When it says the 4 fasts, it's Tzom Gedalia, the fast of Gedalia, the 10th of Tevet, the 17th of Tammuz, and Tisha B'Av. 3 minor, 1 major. Fast of Esther, different story. It seems as though you need to understand that those are the 4 because of a verse from the prophets that say that these fasts will one day be turned to joy. We're going to see that verse if we get through all these different sources, but there is a verse that I included in the packet here about the roots of the fast. And one day all those will be turned into joy, and those 4 fasts deal with historical reality. Historical reality. And that's why they're in a historical reality of the sieges of Israel and Jerusalem. Now, Ta'anit Esther is a different fast because of the fast in Persia. And it's not included in those prophecies that are in the books of the prophets that we take this Jewish custom and fasting of these specific 4 days on. And the fast of Yom Kippur is a fast that's dealt with distinctly and separately, and that was Masechet Yoma that we learned together, where the whole fast of Yom Kippur is there. And yet, we saw over there that sometimes the Gemara liked to deal with bringing in a little bit of the what we do and how we do and what it means in the fasts we're talking about now, these 4 fasts. Back to here, so these 4 fasts are very important, and one should not opt out of them. Why does a Jewish law ever come and express the notion that one shouldn't lifrotz gader, one shouldn't jump ship, breach the fence? Why do you think it's saying that? Because people breach the fence.
What's the fence? Gader.
It's the fence. It's the fence of halacha. It's the fence of tradition. It's the fence of... We know that there are certain communities who don't take these minor day fasts so seriously. He says right in the codes, in the way the language is working here. You don't... No. The right way of thinking about these is, these are important, and if I do this, I'm breaching the fence. There's a different version in manuscript form. It says, v'asur, to separate oneself from the community. So it uses a terminology that's found in Pirkei Avot. And says, the community is fasting today. Your people are fasting today. So these 4 fasts, get serious about them, folks. But here's the next piece. So you see how, if you're looking in the Hebrew with me, there's a bold title in the middle of page 9. There's a little bit of a bigger Hebrew font, and there's a little bit of a smaller Hebrew font, right? The reason is because in the Shulchan Aruch itself, you have what's called a siman, a title, and that's the bold type. And then I have a se'if. And that se'if starts Hakol Chayvin, right? This is the way that the book is divided. And that's Rabbi Yosef Karo, the bigger Hebrew, that's not bold. And then I have something that starts with Hey Gimel Hey. And that's the quote-unquote editorial comment of the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles. Ramah, in this case, being Resh Mem Aleph, and not like the camp, Resh Mem Hay. Rabbi Moshe Isserles. And Rabbi Moshe Isserles wants to add sometimes different kinds of either glosses about what's happening in the lands of Ashkenaz, or he has something to add that gives us dimensionality that you might be wondering. So he says, Mihu, however, remember I told you everybody has to fast and don't break the fence, don't breach the fence. Ubarot umenikot, women who are pregnant who are nursing, shemitztayarot harbe, if they have a lot of suffering, ein lehitanot, shouldn't fast. And he also tells you in this book, in this version, that Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon said that was what they understood the Rambam to be saying as well, centuries earlier. Remember, Rabbi Moshe Isserles is 16th century Krakow. Rambam is 11th century. The afilu einan mitztayarot ein mechuyavot litanot ela shenahagu l'hachamir. They're not, and even if they would suffer, they are not obliged to fast, unless what? Unless, Eila, shenahagu l'hachamir. Unless they were really stringent. So if you have a community that is really stringent, and the women do take it on themselves to fast, then it's okay. It's not like it's completely forbidden. V'davka b'shloshat somot. That is what I'm talking about when it comes to the three minor fasts. So now he could have had that as like the beginning of the sentence, right? But in Hebrew, we get that kind of wrap-up statement. And by the way, I was just talking about the three. So for the three minor fasts, here's the thing. Pregnant women and those nursing who would suffer a little don't have to fast, but if they're very religiously strict, it's permitted. We don't stop them. And by the way, now, about the Tisha B'Av, but for Tisha B'Av, mechuyavot lahashlim. They are obligated to fulfill the fast. So the answer really is, that's where we stand today. By the way, if you ask me on top of that, what if a doctor really says that it's completely dangerous? The answer is, I have a way for you to eat. And that was in the spirit of, remember when we learned Masechet Yoma. Already, how could the question be, like, how much of a bite of a date can I take on Yom Kippur, and what do I do if someone's really ill, and all this kind of jazz? You'd figure that they would be so strict that it would be, just, you know, for absolute absolution, and we need kapara, and Yom Kippur really stood there. But right from the beginning of the ritualistic chapter about Yom Kippur, we see all kinds of flexibility, but we have a unique way of actually doing it. So I'll tell you a story about that. Which we mentioned when we studied Masechet Yomaj, but just to remember, someone was really feeling ill and like her illness would be really, it would be dangerous for her to not eat. And as a matter of fact, it really wasn't an illness that was either deathly or totally life-threatening, but I asked this woman and she definitely wanted to be in the halachic process, so I wasn't kind of really pressuring her to do this. She asked me, what do I really need to do if I really want to have this? I said, well, you should get an opinion by a medical doctor who is also a psychiatrist. And so she went and she got a medical opinion, and the medical opinion said very definitively that it would be not a good idea for her to miss one day of eating in a kind of, you know, quote-unquote, a normal amount of calories, but it could be less than regular calories day, but it needed to be a calories day. So I said, very good, I so appreciate that you went to do that medically, and so let me work with you through the Mishnah and through the passage of the Talmud that explains how you eat on Yom Kippur if you need to eat. And she did this, and she ate only remember we had an egg bulk? And we talked about dates and half a lug and how much to swish in your mouth and all this. She wanted to do it all. She wanted to do it all, just like the Mishnah and just like the Gemara said, so that she could feel as though she was still participating. Because she was machmira al atzma. She took seriously the religious obligation that's reflected in this terminology here. So it's not just like some but out there neo-anxious frumkeit that mentions that if they're very, very machmir, if they're very strict on themselves. I want to kind of take that off the table, because it's easy for us, I think, sometimes to slip into this notion that, oh my goodness, are they that serious? They're nursing a kid, they're pregnant. Like, how could they be so strict on themselves? Right? No, for some people, this was unbelievable. Actually, it was with Eliana. I remember Eliana had great what to say about this tshuva that we learned together right here in this Beit Midrash. There was a great question that we were looking at for Shari Tzedek Posek, a rabbi in Shari Tzedek at the hospital in Jerusalem. And some of the patients had gotten together to ask a collective question. We know we're ill. We know we're in treatment. We know we have this regimen of eating. We know. And Yom Kippur is coming, and we all want to fast. Would you permit it? And this rabbi had to go through all of the sources and all of the serious thinking, because, when we talked about this, was it just their neuroses coming out, that if they don't fast on Yom Kippur, they're actually going to be somehow, you know, stricken with some kind of, you just mentioned this about Yom Kippur, that their Yom Kippur wouldn't avail them of any kind of spiritual salvation whatsoever, or do we respect what they were really asking? And that is, I live by this halakha, and despite my illness, I really want to be considered part of Klal Yisrael. I really want to be considered part of the Jewish people. I really want to engage the practice that I know is our practice of making atonement before God. And I really want to fast. And there were these incredible answers and incredible consultations with each of the patient's families, and the rabbinate in the hospital made a commitment to not only consult with the patient him or herself, but ask permission to consult with that patient's family. And the process of actually coming up with answers for each of them was individualized, even though the question came in general. It was an incredible group of writings. Nurses themselves expressed some consternation about the whole enterprise of it all, and they listened to the doctors in addition to the nurses as well. And there was shikulim among the rabbanim, among the rabbis. There were debates based on doctors' reportage, charts, and nurses' reportage concerning the patient. Really incredible by way of what was out there. This was on a blog, an halachic blog from Israel. All right, back to our episode and show here. So that was the question about, Jay, maybe you saw something on page 10.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Shulchan Aruch. Turn to page 10 of the packet. We'll just finish up with... since we were in that inyan. So the Orach Chaim, the Shulchan Aruch goes on. Ubarot minikot mit anot b'tisha b'av. Pregnant and nursing women fast on Tisha B'av. Umashlimot kederach shemitanot umashlimot b'yom Kippur. Just as they fast and complete on the fast of Yom Kippur. So let me just use that to talk about, you didn't just get fast. What's the phrase here? What's the halachic phrase? Fast and complete. So this is important just by way of recognizing, in terms of the language of fasting, that one can start a fast, and of course there are times when one breaks it before the time that's over. But here you're talking about fasting and completing. And halachic literature, as well as the Mishnah, back when it was formed, uses this language of fasting and completing. And the Mishnah will say, sometimes you begin a fast, but they don't complete it. And so, we get the sense that there is some power and there is some spiritual capacity to become the prayer who makes requests of heaven if I fast for only part of the time and then I don't completely complete it, if I don't entirely complete it. So that's just to put it out there, that's a phrase in and of itself that we often think of just the phrase of fasting, but fasting and completing is a concept within Mishnaic and Halachic literature. So back to the actual words here. So pregnant and nursing women fast on the ninth of Av, just as they fast and complete the fast on Yom Kippur. Aval, but, the Gimel Tzomos Acherim, on the other three fasts, piturot milahitanot. They are exempt from fasting. Vafa pichen, but even though, ra'ui shelo tochalena lehitaneg b'ma'achal v'mishteh. But even if they're exempt from fasting, it's proper that eating and drinking should be solely for the purpose of sustaining the baby. Eila kede kiyum havalat. Instead of deriving enjoyment from the food and drink. So what you're doing by way of the Orach Chaim Seif that Rabbi Caro wrote is, what did he say? He says explicitly, unlike the Ramah, who worded it a little differently, right? We just saw the Ramah before. He said, if they're going to suffer, they don't have to, right? But if they want to be machmir on themselves, machmirot, they can. Right? That's what he said. Over here, Rabbi Caro says, they're piturot milahitanot. What's the word piturah? Piturot?
Exempt.
Not obliged. They're exempt. They're completely exempt. And they shouldn't what? Eat to their heart's content and make a big mishteh and have a feast of sorts. That is used also in the Ramah's language, but it's used a little differently. So here he's exempting them. And that's the point of having both of those sources. Pesachim. It was already in the Gemara that it said, Darash Rava, Uberot Minikot Mitanot Umashlimot, Bo Kederech Shemitanot Umashlimot Yom Kippurim. We're talking about the 9th of Av, and we're talking about Yom Kippur, and women absolutely do that. Uvena Shemashot, and during twilight on the 9th of Av, Asur is prohibited to eat or drink. And they likewise say in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, V'chein Amru Mishmei de Rabbi Yochanan, Umi Amar Rabbi Yochanan, and did Rabbi Yochanan actually... they say that's in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Umi Amar Rabbi Yochanan, did Rabbi Yochanan really say that? Is he the one? V'chi v'ha amar Rabbi Yochanan. Isn't this what Rabbi Yochanan really said? Tisha b'av, ein oknat ketanit tzibor. That is not like a communal, that the ninth of Av is not like a communal fast decreed to pray for rain. My love, levena shemashot lo l'malacha. The ninth of Av is not like a communal fast decreed to pray for rain. What, isn't it referring to the matter of twilight? Meaning apparently Rabbi Yochanan held that it's permitted to eat and drink during twilight on the 9th of Av. And the Gemara answers, no, it's referring to performing labor, which is prohibited on the 9th of Av, in contrast to other fasts. So we get questions about what can be done at the kind of right on the eve of a fast. We get questions as to whether or not the fast means that I start and I complete it all the way through. Or maybe it's I fast and I have a certain time that I break it before the end of a fast. Or maybe it's I start it and I go, you know, one could think as long as I could. We didn't see that, but I'm just throwing it out there. You know, maybe there's some questions about that. And, you know, in terms of Rabbi Yochanan, that, you know, he didn't say it's prohibited to eat or drink. Maybe they were talking about doing work. And so right up to it, what's the difference, by the way? That if I can eat or drink right before a fast, it's very different than if I have to finish it long before twilight, right? Like right up to it versus earlier in the day. So, bottom line about nursing and pregnant women. Shulchan Aruch says they're exempt. Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles in Poland says, a little bit different, if they're going to, Dominica, mitzarot harbe ein lehitanot. If they're going to really suffer, shouldn't fast. Right? But, they're not really going to suffer, and they're not really, really obligated to fast. But they really had the practice to be religious and fast. They should. They could. Because he has a version of society in Ashkenaz. By the way, some people think, why is it that we get a little bit of a nod towards including women sometimes in activities in the public? Well, people who wrote about this issue in terms of tefillah already wrote about the reality. Judith Hauptman had an article about this by way of Torah reading. Why somewhere in some places, in minority of cases, but why sometimes do we get women who are actually included in these kinds of activities, like chanting Torah and reading it for the public? Because in Ashkenaz, you had little communities that didn't have a lot of people. And now and then, depending on who's there, you needed the people who could be learned and who could do what was necessary. Also, it would look strange in a smaller community if, quote-unquote, you know, you didn't have large groups who could communally come together for this fasting purpose. And, you know, let's say that there wasn't such a communal space where all the men are going, but more it's just, you know, you kind of live the way you live in your own homes, and it doesn't seem right, and you have children, and you need to be educating them. Well, for someone to be sitting there and actually eating all day, who's an adult, it might not look exactly right. So we thought about the mimesis issue of passing along an inherited tradition and what that kind of looks like and feels like in the home. Am I going to think of myself as wanting to do what my fasting father is doing, or am I going to think of myself as, even if I have to not eat dessert, you know, kind of sit here on that day of the year and do what my mother does? Well, there's some pull to what my mother does. Trust me. In life, right? People have that. So I think that in Ashkenaz, women's piety became a central issue. And because it was so close to the education of their children and passing along this heritage, I think that it probably becomes even more of an issue than it's already been made out to be. But women's piety in the Middle Ages has become really a point of focus for scholars for some of these reasons. So, from Middle Ages back to Talmudic times. We want to say anything about, by the way, because we're going to leave this, we want to say anything about pregnant women, nursing women? How did the sources fall in terms of your ears?
Yep.
Okay? Sound good? Nobody wants to argue that on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur they're fully required, and it doesn't sound like we ought to start from that place.
No. Maybe I have a more, maybe I came late, a more fundamental question. How does fasting address the, in the very first page, is when you're beset by trouble, you should fast. How does fasting resolve that stuff? Does it make it the prayer more meaningful? Is it, what's the purpose for fasting?
Great. So we talked a little bit about that last week, and I've had some time to think about it, so I'm glad you asked the question aloud again, because now I have a different answer. So.
Well, you mentioned, you spoke about it at the introduction.
A little bit, but we really addressed this issue, like, will the fast actually create the reality that we hope for? Right? That's the bottom line. So, what I was claiming last week was that, A, even though some people complain that fasting really bothers them to such a degree that they can't really focus on their prayers, I've heard that before. I think that's probably connected to the fact that we eat so many calories now, and it's such a huge cliff to fall off that it really feels like, you know.
Still fun activity.
Yeah. But I really do think that fasting does change your composure for the day, your sense of focus for the day, and that especially in an ancient religious practice kind of way, really got you focused on the task, the spiritual task ahead. If that spiritual task was the actually gorem davar, that what changed the notion on high, we can say from a theoretical perspective about what we believe and what our ancestors believed, that there was some sense that when this was prescribed, there was a hit aruta de la'ela, as it's called in later sources. There's a movement of God through what's going on down on earth below. And that there was a fundamental belief that we could help God see that we were deserving. Because we already believe from Torah, right, very much so, that our sins would have an impact on God's decisions to run the world as God should run the world. Beyond that, what I claimed last week and what I still hold is that if we were in the practice of really fasting and focusing deeply and had deep focus days like fast days are supposed to be, who knows what kind of mental capacitation that would create in those who had the greatest capacity to deal with the suffering and the tsuris that we have in our world. And I really do believe in a certain way that you could make the argument, okay, so maybe rain won't fall, but maybe with the deep intention of the mitzvah of taking life back to the Holy Land, let's say, that somehow there was spiritual capacity building that led to some of the great inventions of helping irrigate the desert to the extent we have. I believe that deeply. I believe that fasting creates also camaraderie and community among those who take it on. And we talked about that too last week, that a fasting community just has a very different experience than a non-fasting community, especially at the end of the day when you're struggling. And lastly, here's what I thought, and I wanted to link this back. I didn't yet last week. I don't know about you. At Ne'ilah time, I have to say, the combination of having great tefillot to sing and fasting going on and the kind of energy that I feel at that point spiritually, like I'm going to just carve out a path for the new year, to me is an unbelievable experience. It's an unbelievable experience. And so, I don't know that everybody can feel that, but I think that we want that to be a creative approach to building a good life. Here, they're looking at it as a creative approach to being in connection with God and asking for the drought to stop. That's what we saw. We saw a community in the Mishnah going through several Mishnayot. I listed them quickly on the sheet so that we'd have them in front of us. They're on page 2 and 3 and 4 of the packet. These are the Mishnayot that we studied last time. Mishnah Tani 1-4, Tani 1-5, Tani 1-6, and Tani 1-7. And again, that was the private individuals, the important individuals, Yichidim, would take on 3 fasts. Mishnah 5, if that didn't work, they would ultimately come and say that the Tribunal of Justice, the Beit Din, would order 3 public and general fast days. It's lawful to eat and drink on the nights preceding them, to work on the days and said fasts, to bathe, to anoint the body, to wear the other shoes, and perform the marriage duty. So you could do all those things on those 3 public fast days. I'm on 3 of 17, and I'm on Mishnah 1-5. So you had individuals fasting on Mishnah 1-4. You had, now the Beit Din says about the community, general community, we're going to have 3 fast days, Monday, Thursday, Monday again. But Mishnah 1-6, if all those have passed, the Beit Din decrees 3 more public and general fasts on which it will be lawful to eat and drink on nights, but on which it's prohibited to work. Should these fasts have passed without their prayers having been favorably answered, Beit Din shall decree 7 more fast days. So that's just a repeat at the beginning of 6 there, about the 6 of the three of the Beit Din, and now I have 7. So I have 3 private, 3 by the Beit Din, 7 then beyond that, when I don't have the favorable answer. Now here we said there's a economic reality too. They differ from the 6 preceding, in as much as on them an alarm is sounded on the shofar, and the shops remain closed, except that on Mondays, towards the evening, the shop shutters of those who sell articles of food can be leaned on. That is, they actually can start to sell bit by bit. Thursdays, they may be entirely taken off in honor of the approaching Sabbath. So there's a little bit of a marketplace and a sharing of whatever grain and storehouse stuff we've got to make Shabbat in our community. So that, we said, was an obligation. And when these have also passed without their prayers having been favorably answered, 1-7, they are to lessen and withdraw themselves from engaging in joyful transactions, erecting of buildings, planting of gardens. We didn't want a community to be built and even simchas to be celebrated if A, there was no food practically, and B, that we felt like we really needed to focus on fixing something within our spiritual lives and making sure we didn't build in sin, or we didn't build in a way that would overcome our energies, not having the rains we need. Okay, so that was the general description of what's going to go on in a time of trouble and a time of drought. So So today, we're going to go now into our Gemara, and we're going to hear more about how this set 3 and 3 and 7 really worked. What do we do? What did it look like as a community when you got and you heard this decree? The shofar sounds, the Beit Din calls. Folks, join the fast. There's power in this. You believed it. You might have questioned it, but you believed it then. And you really had to be part of it. So what is the procedure for fasting? So I'm going to now start on 15a2, and we're going to start in some Mishnayot in chapter 2. Yeah, you can close your source sheets, the outside ones, and you can go into the Gemara. Into the Mishnah now, really. The new Koren Steinsaltz edition will say about the introduction to chapter 2, bring two small passages. I'm on page 83 for the couple of you who have this version. When heaven's closed up and there's no rain, when they sin against you, if they pray toward this place and confess your name and turn from their sin when you afflict them, then you hear in heaven and forgive the sin of your servants and of your people Israel, when you teach them the good way in which they should walk, and send rain upon your land, which you have given to your people as an inheritance. So this is from Kings. And Joel the prophet says, blow the horn in Zion, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, and those who suck the breast. Let the bridegroom go forth from his chamber, and the bride out of her pavilion. Let the priests, the ministers of the Lord, weep between the entrance hall and the altar, and let them say, spare your people, O Lord, and give not your heritage to reproach, that the nations should make them a byword. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? Then the Lord was jealous for his land, and had pity upon his people, and the Lord answered and said to his people, behold, I will send you corn and wine and oil, and you shall be satisfied with it. And I will no more make you a reproach among the nations. So, who went out? Everybody went out, according to Joel. Or at least they were called upon to go out. There's actually a little bit of a problem with this passage in Joel. I'll just point it out as follows. I know you don't have it in front of you. Call a solemn assembly, gather the people, we get all the instructions. The bride and the bridegroom and the priests and the ministers. That's a reference to our Mishnah that said, remember, we're not going to have weddings right now. We're going to take care of business and fast and get everybody together. And so that's the call that's made in these verses. The big problem in Bible studies with this passage is that there's no description of the people actually doing this in the verses. It says, this is what you should do, this is what you should do, this is what you should do. And it says, then the Lord was jealous for his land. So the obvious answer is, well, obviously they did it. They all came out, they all engaged in this public outcrying and praying and collecting themselves. And what formula did they, or what halachic framework, what rules did they use? What defined the rules of the game? Our ancient texts, the ones we just learned, the ones we reviewed from chapter 1 of Tanit. And what prayers did they say in Joel's time? Who knows how much of what we're about to read in the Mishnah was around. I wanted to have some historical perspective going in to read the Mishnah that we're about to read. When did that liturgy actually get collected and coined and rehearsed and made available, and who really knew it, and how did it get into the Mishnah? Was it in manuscript form? Did a few folks really keep it and only a few folks really retain it because of the oral culture? And where does it come from? And we can't answer the exact questions as to exactly when the liturgy is from, even with the Amidah itself. We think Mordechai and the people of the Great Assembly that were not in the land and then in the land were among those who started to formulate the 19 blessings we call today the Amidah. By the time of the Gemara, they're not all that liturgy is not in the Talmud, but it is assumed that one says the Amidah because we refer to the prayer. In our Mishnah, it will be an assumption that you know what the prayer or the Amidah is. But there is, again, no review of what that liturgy really is. So if you ask me, well, does Eremita sound exactly like Eremita? I could tell you that the end of the Eremita probably is exactly like Eremita, each ending bracha, which is called a chatima. It's a signature. A chatima is a stamp, or like with wax seals? They made the wax seal, and Washington's spies knew how to take that off and remake each one. You know, great spy work. But those chatimot, those seals on blessings in the ancient world, were probably exactly the same. And the liturgy that grew up into the Amidah that we know today was actually being formulated, could have been already formulated by the Mishnah time, and then just recorded for the first time in the Gaonic era, 8th to 11th century, and squarely used throughout the entire time. But these are questions that we have about lots of liturgy for which we don't have manuscripts. Liturgy of an everyday Amidah, liturgy of high holidays. We have names of the sections that were said in the temple service, but for sure we don't have manuscript form, even if we have sometimes recorded in the Gemara segments and parts of the liturgies of the ancient world. So here too, in our Mishnah, again, historical reality to base ourselves in as we approach this Mishnah in chapter 2, there's an assumption you know what it means, just like at the beginning of chapter 1, that you have an Amidah. Because in chapter 1 we decided when we're going to start saying who Mashiv HaRuach HaMorid HaGashem, right? Who makes the wind blow and brings the rain. Over here, after I've had fast days publicly declared, what do I do? I'm going to need to be a Jew who understands already what the Mishnah is telling me, that during my Amidah, here's what I'm going to be adding. During our prayer service, here's what it's going to look like and sound like. And so you could say to yourself, pretty much like we still hold the line with today at Or Zeruah, these could have been some of the very ways that our ancestors gathered to pray. And you'll understand what it's saying because we are literate to this day about these prayers that they were saying then, and they had forms for already then, that is, thousands of years ago. So, chapter 2. This following Mishnah is going to delineate the special procedure for the prayer service observed on the public fast days. So, Seder Taniyot Ketzad. Right? So you know the word Seder is not just the Pesach Seder. It's the order of things. That's why we call the Seder, right? Steps of the Seder, the order of the parts of the Haggadah. So Seder. Seder Taniyot, the word Seder could also be used for the order of prayers in any given service. What's the Seder of the prayers for the morning min? What's the Seder of the public fast day prayer service? Motzi'in et hateva l'rechova shel ir. I love it. They start out with aesthetics here. They start out with that of the local Beit Knesset. We bring the ark from the synagogue out into the middle of town square. So if you thought that we couldn't take the ark out into the middle of town square already in thousands of years ago, they were doing so on very special fast days. By the way, when have I seen an ark go into the middle of town square? Okay, so
Simchat Torah.
Simchat Torah. A lot of people, though, only see the Torahs being danced into town square. I actually saw in Detroit, on the block off of West Bloomfield Road, they actually had a portable ark to put in the middle of the road so that they could return the Torahs back into the ark. And also, on Simchat Torah over here, on where is it? 77th? So,
I've never seen the Aron in the street.
You know that one year, there was an Aron in the middle of the street over here in the Chabad of the East Side.
Well, they paraded the Torahs when we moved buildings,
didn't they? Yeah, but we didn't have Aron outside. We just paraded them.
Probably held a chuppah over them, something like that.
No, it was pouring rain that day. We had them all wrapped in clear tarps. It was wonderful, but we didn't have
Gishmei bracha, you see? Rains of blessing. Because you didn't sin. This community was... Wow. Okay, so what do? You bring the ark to the middle of town square. Motziin et ha-teva l'rechova shalir. Bring the ark from the synagogue out to the town square. And the Sefer Torah is inside it, in other words. V'not nin efer mikle al gabei ha-teva. And we place ashes upon the ark. This is really, really, if you imagine ashes, right? Who's dealing with the ashes has black ash all over. Right? You don't just deal with putting a little ash somewhere. You've got, really, you've got to feel this aesthetic. Right? This is covering the ark with ash. So dark. So dark. On the other hand, it's reminiscent of a rain cloud. Ashes, they say in the ancient world, in terms of praying for rain, ashes became, they think, potentially, some of the first forms of what we should reflect on the ground pictorially if we wanted to use some type of image in our prayer service.
Ashes.
Ashes.
So I have to step out. Is this any relation to Ash Wednesday? I mean, is it the same concept as ashes?
Is it? Yeah, it is today. It's
yeah.
Funny.
It is today, yeah.
I do not know the answer to the question, first of all. But secondly, you know that there was a tradition to put ashes on your forehead on Tisha B'Av.
Oh.
And there is a use of ashes within the Jewish tradition long before there's any use of ashes in Christianity.
It's ashes and sackcloth, usually.
Ashes and sackcloth, right. We have when the notion of mourning, especially for the destruction of the temple, people will sit in ashes and sackcloth and wear specialized kind of wraps of sandals that are also, some say, ashen sandals, that their feet were kind of on the ashes of the destruction of the temple.
You also have it in Jonah. I always remember it. That's my connection. But where did he go to Nineveh? The king declared a fast day and had everybody, including the animals, fast, and the people sit in sackcloth and ashes.
Right. So ashes are part of the ancient practice of fasting, and in that vein too, just to get back to it, it could be just that they were kind of painted on, and the ashen color itself was the kind of dark times that were experienced. Could have been somewhat of a way to pictorially represent storm clouds, which I find fascinating. Just one suggestion about ancient aesthetics and ritual. Well, I would think that they're still, with whatever grain they've got in storehouses, still firing up their ovens. You still have to cook. And you don't have anything but natural fuels. So I imagine they took from there. There's the notion of it being around the temple, if we're talking about the true temple precincts and the fire that's Tukad Bo, there's a fire every day. And there's the fire of the menorah. And so whatever way you're going to get this from some holy usage of the ashes and or everyday usage of ashes, depending on the community, I think you could probably just count on having them.
So creating the ashes themselves may remind you of a cloud, but creating the ashes will generate a cloud. Not a rain cloud, but a cloud. A
cloud of smoke.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. The question that you're making me think about is, do we have anywhere where the description of how we get these specific ashes, do we have anywhere that really describes exactly where they're from? And I think I have one spot post-noted in a book that I'll look for this week, Gleaneder, okay? Because I don't recall what the scholar was saying there, but I don't want to misreport.
No.
Okay? But that, thank you for that.
But there was no halacha about what kind of ash, what tree.
Yeah, that's
right. This would be what you'd expect.
Well, footnote 3 says it. Well, footnote 3 addresses that.
And then you need to have food, but they have no food, so there is no ash here.
Yeah, there...
You should have a comment in the...
Footnote 3.
That says it's stam, afar stam.
Yeah.
Or afar, I don't know how to pronounce it.
It's ever mamish velo afar, ever stam hu afar dik shem she ever kerui afar dichtiv me afar sreifat chetot kach afar kerui ever stam. I knew the ketani ever. Do you have a comment in there, Jay, that summarizes it?
In here?
No,
yeah.
Do you
a,
have it down there?
There's a comment.
Can you read it out? Burnt ashes. Rashi and many other commentaries explain that burnt ashes are placed on the forehead as a sign of humiliation, as they are more demeaning than dirt. Others add these ashes are called burnt to differentiate them from ashes of the red heifer. Tosfot and Aruch cite several interpretations of the term burnt ashes. According to one opinion, it refers to ashes from burnt coals. According to another, it means ashes from a stove. Okay, that's, so that's, I was remembering the stove answer. While a third interpretation is that it refers to ashes formed from a burnt human corpse.
Here they say that it's ashes.
I don't know.
So you asked, there are details.
You're
right, yeah. It wasn't so simple.
What it says here is ashes from burning in this version. That the Mishnah here adds mikle, burning, to make it clear that we are referring to the residue of fire, which we're going to see in a second. We didn't see that word yet, right? We say,
no,
we did. Oh, we did. We don't need ever mikle al gabe ateva, burnt ashes, uva rosh anasi, uva rosh az beitin, and upon the head of the nasi and upon the head of the chief of the court, which is what I wanted to come back to, Jonathan, about your question. We already see it's on the heads of people who are over here. Yeah, and it very well may be connected to that. And v'chol echad v'echad notein barosho, and everyone else places ashes upon his own head. So we have ashes in so many places, and mikle is this notion of burnt, and that's why I was talking about the stove or from the ashes of the menorah. And I think there's one source that I read that said it has to be from holy ashes, and there was a supply of holy ashes from everybody. Now I'm really back into this passage, and there was a supply of holy ashes, and the holy ashes were from all the ashes that were collected over time from...
Which makes sense. There's this whole thing of using ashes because it's more demeaning than earth.
Right.
It makes no sense if you're going to put them on the
altar. Right. Well, in that sense, they're basically saying, we are the ones who demeaned your name, God, because we've sinned. So in terms of that darkness that's overcome us, it could be from the sin that we've committed. On the other hand, if it's that, we're just going to be nothing, we're going to be dust and ashes in a minute here, God, if you don't send rain. It's kind of like something to challenge God with, and we're keeping your holy ways. So if it was holy ashes, then it made a point that it was kind of like the ashes themselves could be prayer in a strange way. Then if it's just ashes of the stove, then it's kind of like we know we need to depend on you, God, for everything, and that the fuel for the fires and the hearths and the ovens came from the trees that only grew because you sent rain and you nourish the earth. And you nourish it for this year and you nourish it for 70 years, a la the Honi story we talked about.
Afar mikle oto afar midvar hanisraf ma'atzamot adam kedei liskor akedat Yitzchak.
Nice.
So he's saying it's not, well, not strictly speaking from a burnt corpse, but from bones, from human bones,
in
memory of Yitzchak, who was bound on the mizbeach.
Where did you see that, Jay?
This is in Tosafot. 16.
You're on 16?
How did that happen? It's on 16.8.
Very good. I haven't delved into that page yet, so thank you for bringing that forward. So let's look.
I didn't realize I got
ahead. Nice, correct. So let's look at the Mishnah here. let's back up to our Mishnah, so that tonight we'll get through a little bit more of this Mishnah before we go. Okay, so you have ashes on the heads. We bring from the Ark of the Synagogue, and we have this Ark, and there's ashes, and it's the special ashes from which whatever source they're going to come from, on the head of the chief of the court and the head of the Nasi, and then it's also everyone else. V'hazaken shebehen omer, the elder among them says, Lifnehem divrei kibushin. He addresses them with words that what? That kibushin. So, Rashi says it's lashon atzira. It's a language of deep sorrow. It's words that what? Overcome the heart or conquer the heart. This word lichbosh is kind of a word that means conquer.
Marketing words.
Marketing words. What else is lichbosh in modern Hebrew?
Oh, you conquer, but that's...
What else is it, though?
Military style.
Kibushim. What do you have on the table before you start to eat?
Kibushim.
Kibushim. Kibush. Lichbosh is to pickle. So I love that translation of this for the Gemara. You stir them with words that will pickle their hearts.
It's not that. My knowledge of this phrase is that, like, not pontificating, but like telling you what you're doing wrong and telling it to you.
Yeah, yeah. So if kibush here is to, like, give him the kibosh.
That's the phrase. That's what the phrase does.
Yeah, yeah. So if
it's used.
If it's to give him the kibosh, as we say, then it's really to hit them over the head. If it's subdue, it's kind of to stir them. If it's
embarrassed.
What?
Embarrassed.
It could be to that level of embarrassed.
Pointing out.
Yeah. So it's at least get them into a sorrowful state. So nice. So Steinsaltz says to give it to them like Musser. To reprimand. To reprimand and reprove them. Yeah. So we have lots of different ways that we could understand it, though. We're not just going to take one translation. We're going to let all the different possibilities stand and understand, though, that the elder in the group, who the respected one, is going to stand up and going to say that we need to truly take on the spirit of this day, and we need to be in this fast, and we need to understand that we hold responsibility. God also, we need to assert ourselves here that we're doing the right thing so that God will bring us the rain in its time. And then he says, the elder brings this word, Achenu. Lo nem arban shei Nineveh, our brethren. It is not stated regarding the people of Nineveh. Or is it not stated?
No,
it is not. Lo nem ar. It's not stated regarding the people of Nineveh. Vayar Elohim et sakam v'et tanitam. And God saw their sackcloth and their fast. No, it's not said that. Ela, what is it said? Vayar Elohim et masehem, that God saw their deeds. Kishavu midarkam hara'ah, that they repented their evil way. So, was it the fast itself? Was it the actual fast? No, was the resolve that you made during your fast to repent from your evil ways. This is quoting Jonah. Now, what's fascinating about this, I talked about it one Yom Kippur, is that when it comes to Jonah and holding up the Ninevites as examples of Balei Tshuva, this is a radical move. It is a radical move to hold up the Ninevites, to include the book of Jonah, and to hold up the non-Jews as examples of people who actually took on to make tshuva and to teach us sometimes how to actually accomplish that. It is one of the most universalist moments in the entire Tanakh. And by the way, Jonah gets upset about it. Right?
Yeah.
Because, no, what about us?
No.
But it's really poignant. And it's included in our Mishnah. Uva Kabbalah Hu Omer. And the word Kabbalah is not used for mysticism in the Mishnah. Kabbalah refers to the books of the prophets and the written traditions. So it's a word that's going to take on different meaning later in terms of the Jewish mystical community, but it's the received tradition. And the received tradition is, of course, the Tanakh, because that's the received written word from on high. Uva Kabbalah Hu Omer, and the prophets it states, V'kiru levavchem v'al bigdeichem, and rend your hearts and not your clothes. I don't need your fast if your heart's not here. I don't need your rituals if your heart and your mind and your spirit is not going to be moved. I need you to truly repent. And amdu b'tfilah, and when they stand and pray in that town square, and in Talmudic usage you see that what we're talking about, amdu b'tfilah is, meaning they stood for their amida, because when I use the word tfilah in the Talmud, I don't mean like just, it's tefillah time. I'm trying to drag them out of bed, get them to minyan. That they're standing and they're about to say their amida, and they're moving into their amida. So when they have their tefillah in town square, moridin lifnei ateva, they send down before the ark to lead the prayers. Right? So you see that there's a note that in ancient times the chazan stood in a well of the floor of the synagogue to evoke the verse, Mi ma'amakim keraticha Adonai. From the depths I call out to you. Instead of like walking up to a bima, we actually sent someone down to lead prayer. Where's the only place that I've ever seen a prayer leadership spot that is down into the earth? I took a tour of the religious sites of the Anasazi people at Mesa Verde. And I wanted to get into their version of a synagogue called a kiva.
Right.
And I went with a researcher from the Native American Heritage Center that's newly funded by the office, the administration of the Native American Heritage Foundation. And in this spot, there was kind of like an equivalent circle around the outside that had lots of chairs. But it was obvious that in one of the kivas, right in the middle, the low point, is for the fire that they build, and it goes out. But there was this little kind of well of a spot. And the theory is that the one who really, really felt as though they were in this lower world, not really connecting with the spirits on high, went down into that place and from the lowest point needed to call. Now, of course, this is on a cliff up high, so you can't say that they were actually fundamentally all the way down, except that they needed to, even being in the cliff, I think even more poignantly, symbolize the fact that they were down on this world's plane versus up on high. Meanwhile, have I ever seen it in, what's that?
In our tradition.
Yeah. So, again, Professor Levine, Lee Levine, will show you in some ancient synagogues that they had such a well. And I've been there on tours in Israel. And so when you go, and right now I'm not recalling the names of the exact sites, but I've stepped into landscapes of the ancient synagogue world where we really do see that Mimamakim, they climb down low and let their prayers soar on high.
So why do we have a bima?
We have a bima because
we elevate.
We have a bima because there was other traditions to walk up the steps to give sacrifices or up ramps to give sacrifices, dressed modestly like the priest, right?
So the bima
since we're a nation of priests, it doesn't really replace it because we never even went that far to say the bima is like the altar. But if prayers replaced sacrifices, then we ought to be going up, right, and making that offering. Okay, so we're going to continue with this Mishnah the next time we meet. The drama is unfolding. They're about to start their Amidah in amidst all the other tefillah that they would have done, and we're going to read about the very content of these ancient days of fasting that they have recorded here right in the Mishnah for us in terms of the liturgy that our ancestors said and the sounds and scents and realities that they experienced in the aesthetics of those days of fasting. Sure, let me collect the source sheets and I'll pass them out again.